the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber, and of course that was Syreeta singing Sunny beautifully, as she always does, and that was Frank Sinatra, the night he hosted The Tonight Show and invited me on to do a stand-up, which you can see on YouTube / johnbarbersworld.com. I'm coming to you live, unfortunately I am alive, from Las Vegas, Nevada, which, as every one of you now knows, is probably a bit the center of the news universe. Ordinarily, I like to start this show by making some humorous comments or observations, but I am certainly not in the mood to do that right now, and I'm sure a lot of you are not in the mood to listen to any of that kind of stuff. I will be getting shortly to the only guest that I have had back on the show three times, the author of two incredible, incredible books about drugs. And one of the reasons that I booked him back, besides the fact that he's a brilliant writer and a brilliant speaker, and he works with drug addicts and has done that for a number of years, is because we have seen that there are a couple of major cities in this country that are on the brink of closing down because of drug deaths. And NBC is scheduling for this upcoming weekend, I think, a show called Overdose of a Nation. And there was no one in this country who is more qualified to talk about drugs in this country. As a matter of fact, I'm holding one of his books right now. It's called Drugs as Weapons Against Us. It is an absolutely brilliant book, and I can't wait to talk to him. But first, I just have a few things that I wish to say about what happened last night. I do not like to express opinions that are not based solidly on facts. And what this happened, the shooting happened in Las Vegas last night around 10:15, and of course it interrupted the news. And it was very difficult to get an eye or an ear on what was happening in Las Vegas because there were conflicting reports. There were reports that there were two gunmen, that one of the gunmen was shot, the other gunman was trapped in a room. There were reports that there were only two deaths, and that there were about 20 serious shootings. It was very, very difficult to find out what was going on. And of course, there was talk about terrorism and speculation and all that on the news. At about 12:30 last night on the NBC outlet in Las Vegas, a reporter found a girl, a 21-year-old girl, who was at the concert in the front row. And she said she was there to celebrate her 21st birthday at this concert. She said that beside her, and this is how she described it, was a short Hispanic woman who kept telling everybody that there were going to be a lot of people killed in a few minutes. And she got to be such a pest that the lady in front of them called security, and security came and escorted this woman out. The 21-year-old said she was escorted out with another Hispanic-looking man. And that was the last they heard of it. And then 20 minutes later, the gunshots started to fire. Now, the one thing that I have noticed is that whenever one of these major calamities happens in this country, the news milks it to death. And the reason for that, they can hang on to viewers. They please the advertisers because they continue to get higher ratings to sell those products for the advertisers. And what happens to stay on the air? There is all kinds of speculation and all kinds of chit-chat and stuff that doesn't really mean anything. I remember back in 1968, the June 5th, 6th, the night that Robert Kennedy was murdered at the Ambassador Hotel, they had at least a dozen witnesses within minutes on the air describing a girl in a black polka dot dress who was not only with Sirhan at the time, but ran out of the Ambassador Hotel hollering, "We caught Kennedy, we caught the son of a bitch." Once they decided that they were going to nail Sirhan, who was obviously not the shooter, according to Dr. Thomas Noguchi, the coroner, because Sirhan was 6 feet in front of Robert Kennedy, and the fatal wound was in the back of the head, about 2.5 inches from the back of the right ear, because of the extensive powder burns, according to Noguchi. But once the law had decided, or the government decided, that this is the path that they were going to nail, you never heard again about the girl in the polka dot dress. So now that they found out that this guy, supposedly, I believe his name is Paddock, he's from an upscale area in Mesquite, Nevada, lives in a very nice house, and the neighbors all said he was very, very pleasant. Once they have decided that this guy is the killer, they're going to call this guy the killer, call this guy the shooter. I wonder if we'll ever hear much more about the girl that the 21-year-old described. Since then, they've put out an all-points bulletin. They gave the girl's name. She's not Hispanic. That was a mistake on that girl's part. Evidently, she's Asian and may have left the country. And they're looking for two automobiles. Now, if Paddock had driven his car to the Mandalay Bay and it's not there, then somebody else was there to drive the car away. And then, obviously, the car that the Asian woman was in. So I have no idea if we will hear any more about that. Now, of course, in order to keep the story on the air, they talk about, well, ISIS is now taking credit for this. First of all, let me tell you something. I said 4 years ago, when they said there was going to be a terrorist attack in Las Vegas, I went on YouTube with a little rant and I said, they are not going to do any meaningless shootings in Las Vegas. If they are real terrorists, they will sneak across the border like they do every day in this country, and they would go to Hoover Dam, and they'd either try to blow the thing up, or they would drop some kind of chemicals in it that would kill all of us. They wouldn't waste their time on a meaningless shooting, because if they were real terrorists, they would commit real terror and not this random shooting. Just a little sidebar note. A lot of the things that are being reported on the internet by people on Facebook are not being reported in the local news. Some of you probably have never heard this, but there was a farmer named Bundy who started taking pot shots at the government a couple of years ago when they invaded his farm here in southern Nevada, claiming that he owed all kinds of money because he was feeding his cattle on government land, and they arrested him. They convicted him in a court in Northern California. The retrial was tried here in Las Vegas. The verdict was about 10 days ago. And in the verdict, it was overturned in the local courtrooms, totally uncovered by anybody in the news except George Knapp, who does Coast to Coast on Sunday night. And Bundy had the conviction reversed. In other words, he beat the government. Now, the government doesn't like folks to know that they can be beaten. Okay, so that story was never reported. So now what is happening on the internet is you get all kinds of weird speculation from people saying that perhaps that this is some kind of false flag to cover up the fact that Bundy beat the federal government. I have no idea. I do not think it's a false flag. Just let me tell you something very, very briefly. About 15 years ago, when I first moved here, I played golf with what looked like a very successful fellow, member of the Legacy Men's Club. I played golf with him once or twice a week. He was in the Legacy Men's Club. One day, on a Saturday in the morning, on a bright sunny day, he drove down to Sunset Station parking lot in his Mercedes, got out of the car, closed the door, took a revolver out of his pocket, and blew his brains out. The reason he got out of the car is he left a note to his girlfriend saying that she didn't want to have to clean the blood and brains out of the new car that he was leaving her. What he had told me a year earlier was that he was so fed up with life in America. He had a half a dozen credit cards. He was going to come to Vegas and live the high life and have as much fun as he could, as many girls as he could, gamble as much as he could until his credit cards were maxed out, and then he was going to blow his brains out. The day at the parking lot at Sunset Station was the day he maxed out his credit cards. Now, this fellow, Paddock, who was at Mandalay Bay, was there from September 28th, so he was there for a few days. It was very, very well planned, and evidently he had an arsenal. But when the bomb went off that blew the door open and they got in, he was already suicided. He was already dead. So maybe he had just had enough, and the psychic pain that he was suffering, for whatever reasons, his life had gone wrong. He decided he was so angry and so enraged, unlike Peter Finch and Network saying, as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. This guy evidently was going to do the same, but he was going to do it with automatic machine guns and automatic rifles. He decided he was going to take some people with him as a way to express his rage. All of this, I hate to say it, this, all of this has been unleashed since Donald Trump became president of the United States. And one of the first things that Trump did is he took the white supremacist group, he took them off the terrorist watch list in this country. Now, there's some reports on Facebook that the FBI had a record on this guy and they were tracking him down because he was supposedly one of these gun nut cases. But if he was a white supremacist, he was no longer considered by Donald Trump as a terrorist. And what happened, I won't mention the name because he's a very successful producer in Hollywood. But within a month after Donald Trump's election, producer of this hit television show, a drama, a police show, said what had happened is that Trump had uncorked the horrible genie locked up in a lot of people, and that was the genie of prejudice. Because what happened in their staff was that a number of very prominent whites working on the staff in this show began attacking and vilifying and calling niggers some of the very successful blacks who were working on the show. And the blacks are in the court to this day taking this show and this network to the courts to seek some kind of solace, and hopefully the same kind of solace that Bundy got when he got his case reversed. I'm not saying anything pro or con Trump, but that is just a fact. It is not an opinion. So it astonishes me, quite honestly, when I look around at what a horrifying, inhumane culture that we live in. A country born on terror with the genociding of Indians, building the country on stealing their land, and in 2017, maintaining the prosperity of this country by attacking and invading seven other countries, all illegally. It is no wonder more people are not going postal. I mean, it just proves that many of us do have an enormous amount of self-restraint. And a lot of us, I went out and bought three Berettas. I have three Berettas and I don't know how to use them. I don't even want to know how to use them. I can't even go to a gun range. I have no desire to fire a gun. I just shoot off my mouth. That's all I'm going to do. Anyway, it is entirely possible that this guy was just planning a horrible suicide to end it all. And they tried on the news, on NBC and CBS, connect him to his brother, who evidently may have been involved with the shooter at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida. I mean, it is all kinds of nonsense. And to hear this business about ISIS may be involved with this or with this fellow or taking credit, I think that is just one American with a really sick sense of humor who is sort of pushing that into the Facebook envelope in the hope that the news will pick it up. And indeed, the news did pick it up. And there are a lot of interesting articles now coming out of the mainstream media talking about why are we having such a problem finding out whether there were two fatalities or 58 fatalities. Are there 516 victims to this shooting, or are there only 20 victims to this shooting? One person who lives in Las Vegas sent me a Facebook note, and he said, John, I wondered at the concert why the floodlights were still on the audience and not on the stage, and that's when the shooting started. Anyway, folks, I'm so glad that you're here. I really feel absolutely dreadful and helpless and hopeless about what has happened in Las Vegas in the last 12 hours. But I even feel more hopeless about what is happening into America. It is just absolutely unraveling before our very eyes. And what I want to do now is introduce and I'm going to keep him on for the whole hour. And in about 25 minutes, I will have him joined by Joe Satilli, who's my indispensable sidekick here. And if anybody has read the best articles and the best insights into what just happened in Las Vegas, I guarantee you it is Joe Satilli. So right now I'm going to introduce the fellow that I wanted to introduce at the top of the show. Two fabulous books about drugs. One I mentioned is Drugs as Weapons Against Us. Back for the third time, and it won't be his last time, I assure you. John Podash. John, welcome so much to the show, and sorry for the delay in introducing you.
No problem. I agree with the whole, with everything you said, and it's sad, very sad.
John Lennon, before he was shot, he said, one wonders what on earth it is about the culture that we live in that forces us to take drugs to escape that culture. Now, I certainly didn't word it as well as John, but what do you think? I mean, we are the most addictive and addicted nation in the entire world. I mean, we are making governments and countries rich all the way from Afghanistan to Vietnam and to South America rich, growing poppies that we buy by the billions of pounds, for crying out loud. What is it about this society, John, that leads people to be taking drugs?
Well, I think what it is that it's the oligarchs that run our country, and I think of the most power in our world, are the ones making the most money off of all these drugs. And they are purposely just sending as many drugs into our society as possible, creating as many new drugs as possible, which they started with contracting loads of scientists through the MKUltra program to do that, and then just pushing them on us in any, you know, every which way they can. They do it in subtle means through the media, and they glorify it through the media. They pretend like it's an underground phenomenon, such as the raves. They pretend as if, you know, that's an underground phenomenon, when I have loads of evidence that there wasn't underground. That was a collusion between the mafia and U.S. intelligence to pretend, you know, to make it look underground when it was really, a push. It was what they call an AstroTurf campaign. They have loads of AstroTurf campaigns, which is fake grassroots work, you know, in terms of it's a PR tactic to make lots of things look like grassroots campaigns, you know, grassroots, you know, people just organizing these big raves, big warehouse parties, where they push tons of psychedelics and ecstasy and all kinds of different drugs. And so this is some of the different ways that they push the drugs on us. And so I don't think it's just us trying to escape as much, though of course there are, you know, people trying to escape a lot of traumas, which they also, you know, affect on us. But they're really just being pushed on us like crazy, and that's what, you know, increases the demand, is just the popularizing of them like crazy. There is also, you know, traumatizing us in a lot of different ways through police brutality, through the wars, through, a lot of different means, and, you know, allowing so much domestic violence and everything else. So there's those things going on also.
It was about 80 years ago, 80 years ago, that Aldous Huxley, I believe, first started writing about the fact, I think the drug he said Americans would be taking, or the Americans in English would be taking, was something called Soma, S-O-M-A. I mean, right. He was even talking in those days. Now, what kind of insights could he have had? Now, you're talking about the elite, the 1%, or the handful of families that literally own this country. Is it entirely possible that Aldous Huxley had those kinds of insights into what was happening in the world?
Well, I think he had a combination of insight plus family members that were part of that British oligarchy that were involved in some of this stuff. And so, you know, he probably knew of some of the machinations of the British oligarchy that were directly connected to the American oligarchy. You know, the royal family, a lot of the American oligarchs, you know, the blue bloods, they call them, are Anglophiles, meaning they love the royalty. They love the British royalty and the other British, you know, wealthiest oligarchs. And so, you know, his family being connected to them, that's part of the way he knew how this could happen, how they would try to have this Soma, you know, different drugs that would just, you know, lull us along in our escapism. And so, you know, Soma represents all drugs, basically. So, yeah, I think he, you know, he just predicted it well based on the evidence of his, you know, the people he knew planning these things and having used these things on their own citizens in terms of opium, with the opium wars, where they, you know, launched that opium war on China to force them to accept their opium and then get them addicted at the highest rate in history. And then they also started developing the, you know, huge rates of morphine addiction amongst poor and working class in Britain at that time, at the same time as there were all these, you know, labor strikes to stop, you know, right after the Industrial Revolution.
One of the interesting stories that I didn't get to fully explore with you last time you were here, and I was glued to it in the book, was the story about the colonel maybe being involved with the federal government in controlling America's major superstar at the time, Elvis Presley. Could you expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, well, Colonel Tom Parker's his name. And so what happened with Elvis is Elvis was a huge white talent who just was very into black music in the early 1950s and mid 1950s, and so he tried to copy their music, and he was a very good looking guy, had a great voice, great dancer. And so music was so incredibly segregated in the United States that they didn't allow a lot of these great black rock and roll musicians, before it was even called rock and roll, you know, but it was called rhythm and blues at that time, onto white radio stations. And so here comes Elvis copying that their style and doing it extremely well. And, he became an instant star. Now, he couldn't handle all that wealth and fame, you know, and how to, you know, booking the concerts and everything like that at age of 21. He just didn't know how to handle it all. So into his life comes this Colonel Tom Parker saying, "I'll handle all this for you." And Elvis didn't know any better. And Colonel Tom Parker proceeds to give Elvis tons of uppers and downers, proceeds to control his life thereafter until his death. And, basically wouldn't allow him to do live concerts for many, many years, helped get him drafted into, of course, the Army, Army.
John, let me ask you a quick question. Was Colonel Parker doing to Elvis what MGM did to Judy Garland? Just drug her to keep her working? Was he just drugging him to keep him under control so he could have? I think he had 50% of Elvis, so he could have that large paycheck.
Yeah, well, I can believe that MGM did that with Judy Garland for sure. I haven't heard of that before, but I totally can believe that. But with Colonel Tom Parker, I think it's something very different. I think he wasn't just doing that to control him, but he was doing that partly also to popularize these drugs amongst Johnny Cash. In the movie about Johnny Cash with Reese Witherspoon and Joaquin Phoenix, you saw that he got into the drugs, you know, because of Elvis, and Elvis, you know, ended up, you know, showing him that way of doing things. Elvis not realizing what was going on. He was just very manipulated. But so he partly, I think, did that to control him, but also, you know, to stop him from head of the American Indian Movement named John Trudell said that he wrote a song about Elvis saying he was a revolutionary Che Guevara in his mind in terms of freeing men's emotions, because men were so stifled and weren't supposed to show their emotions at that time. And for him, it was revolutionary the way it freed, you know, men's emotions. And so, you know, you want to control him that way and make him more robotic with the drugs. Elvis was actually very anti-racism at the time, and so he wanted to control him in that regard and stop him from popularizing all these anti-racist, beliefs of his, being the most popular guy in America. There was, a number of ways, he was looking to control him. And I argue that he wasn't just doing that for his own benefit, Colonel Tom Parker, but he was, one of the highest-ranking members of the National Guard, who are often used for special forces projects and for U.S. intelligence and MKUltra projects. So, for example, special forces are used in, they came from the National Army Reserves, National Guard, and are called Green Berets, and were used in the sense of in the assassination of Martin Luther King, according to William Pepper, the top researcher on that subject, who's written some great books and represented the King family in that famous lawsuit they had in 1999 that they won against the government. So this is, this has a history of using people like Tom Parker for these special projects, and I just show that this is just one example of the way they use drugs to control musicians, to partly to popularize the drugs and partly to control the musician. And then when the musician tried to get out of that control, they usually did them in. So I didn't have time to go real deeply into the last years of Elvis's life, but with the main musicians I talk about in the book, I show how when these musicians such as John Lennon, Jimi Hendrix, and of course Kurt Cobain and Tupac Shakur started breaking out of the control of the attempted control by U.S. intelligence, they were done in by U.S. intelligence.
What, You said there was an attempt to control these four people by U.S. intelligence. Obviously, John Lennon resisted successfully very strongly for a while until he was eventually assassinated. But Tupac Shakur, do you think U.S. intelligence was trying to control his success and the messages of his songs?
Yeah. Now, John Lennon, I kind of argue that it was a constant struggle back and forth with John Lennon and U.S. intelligence, because U.S. intelligence manipulated John Lennon to partly popularize LSD, and they were successful with that. He did help popularize LSD, and that was the top MKUltra drug that they're trying to push on the activists, like the civil rights activists and the anti-war activists, to divert them away from their best activism, because their research showed that it takes away from the best competency and the best strategizing, because it's causing some mild damage that it's not that it's completely, or it's not, it can be reversible, but it lasts a while, that damage that it does, that so much acid that was made so popular in the 60s. So that was effective. They controlled him that way, but at the same time, other people were trying to help John Lennon resist that control. And so Marshall McLuhan, for example, talked to John Lennon and said they're trying to manipulate you, they're trying to play you as the fool and make you have you popularize these drugs. And John Lennon started turning on the control and started resisting talking out loudly against the Vietnam War and all that. But it was a back and forth. He then, John Lennon then developed a heroin problem, and which he talked about in the song "Me and My Monkey," and so it's it was a big struggle, and the same way with Tupac Shakur, it was a constant struggle. Tupac was a revolutionary activist, and when I say revolutionary, I mean just trying to change society for the better from birth. His mother, Fannie Shakur, was a one-time leader of the Harlem Black Panthers and called her son Tupac, the Black Prince of the Revolution. And so when Tupac came of age, he was already head of the New African Panthers at 18 years old, which was the national Black Panther leader, or New African Panther leader. And so then he went to music. And so, they tried to manipulate him as much as possible. He resisted, but then when they got him in jail, that's when the CIA really took over and got him signed to Death Row Records, which was the U.S. intelligence front company. Death Row Records proceeds to put out the most negative lyrics of Tupac. From that point on, they're completely glorifying smoking weed, glorifying drug dealing in the biggest way possible. And when Tupac finally said, "I'm done with my Death Row contract and I'm leaving Death Row Records," they were worried that they couldn't manipulate that negative, aspect of him, because that negative aspect of him was really a political plan to pretend to be a gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them. That was part of his Black Panther family's plan, which was succeeding nationwide to politicize, gangs and to get the Bloods and Crips to call peace truces. Those peace truces were spreading nationwide, and they were turning on to activism, and they were stopping their drug dealing. So that was also costing the oligarchs billions of dollars
I must say, John, the research in your books and the writing, just absolutely incredible. I would like you to mention the titles of both of the books, where they can get them, and then I want you to stay with us when we bring Joe on. So the titles of the books and where people can get them. And I will have one more question about Elvis after you do that. Go ahead.
Sure. So the first book is titled "The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders." And the subtitles are long, but just to give you the whole kind of breadth of the book, which in the subtitle is "The FBI, U.S. Intelligence's Murderous Targeting of Tupac, MLK, Malcolm, and Panthers, Hendrix, Marley, Rappers, and Linked Ethnic Leftists." Now, the second book, similarly titled, is "Drugs as Weapons Against Us," and the subtitle is "The CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and Other Activists." You can get both books either at Amazon.com. The second book is available at Drugs as Weapons Against Us at Barnes & Noble. Or you can also go to my website, which is drugsasweapons.com. Again, that's drugsasweapons.com, where you can buy the books either directly from me if you'd like. And there's a film based on the first book that's available on the website. And the second book, I'm just finishing up the film one right now, and excited to put that out soon. We'll see how soon I can get out.
That's wonderful, John. So one last quick question.
Sure.
About Elvis before we bring Joe in. Almost every actor or actress who becomes successful has turned down numerous roles that they wish they had taken. Doris Day turned down the role in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, for which she would be perfect, and went to Ellen Bernstein. And of course, everyone knows that probably the greatest gangster movie ever made was The Godfather, made great by the performance, especially of Marlon Brando as The Godfather. And that part was turned down by Laurence Olivier. He was first offered it. Now, in Elvis's case, were there roles in great films that he would have been perfect in, but the Colonel turned them down for him?
Yeah, I heard that the Colonel made him turn down A Star Is Born, as well as, I think it was West Side Story and other great films where they wanted him to star.
He'd have been wonderful in West Side Story. He'd have been perfect. And maybe even in A Star Is Born. Now, why would the Colonel do that?
Because the Colonel wanted to keep him in more robotic kind of roles, where it was just like real stock type of films, where he didn't really show his really intense emotions. He was very open, expressive emotionally, and they wanted to keep him in these roles that the uppers and downers could just take him through, constantly on uppers and downers.
If Elvis was the goose that was laying the golden egg, why would he stuff him with these drugs that he obviously could see were going to kill him? I mean, any idiot could see that guy who looked like he was now on Orson Welles' diet was going to be dead soon.
Yeah, so that's my evidence that this is not about money. This was not about Colonel Tom Parker making money off him. He was working for U.S. intelligence, and it was about social control versus money. Uh-huh. It was about pushing the uppers and downers. It was about presenting more robotic emotions. It was very different than money.
You want to know something? In death, Elvis Presley's image probably makes the Colonel as much money as when Elvis was alive.
Mm-hmm. God. Very sad, because he was, when he first started, he was just so emotionally intense and really inspiring in that way. Inspiring for his, for his constantly going to black shows in the height of segregation, constantly telling people, I'm not the king of rock. People like Bo Diddley and all these great black, stars of the king of rock.
I was a mailboy at Paramount when Al Wallace was making one of Elvis's first movies, and I got to meet him very, very briefly. I must tell you, he was the sweetest, gentlest, kindest Southerner that I had ever met until I met Jim Garrison. I mean, he was just a sweet soul, and how he ended up is baffling. And I saw his last performance, his last good performance at the International Hotel here in Las Vegas. And it was breathtakingly magnificent. He was a wonderful performer. Anyway, with that, stay there. Joe, are you there?
I am here and just enjoying the ride.
Oh,
hey,
Joe.
John.
Thank you so much for being here. Joe, your observations, first of all, on what John has been talking about. Maybe your thoughts on...
Well, I have a question for John.
Sure, go ahead.
John, have you looked into the Sackler family? Sackler family, have made at least $14 billion, if not more, off of Purdue Pharma, which was the original purveyor of OxyContin.
Well, yeah, no, I haven't. I wish I had. Yeah, no, that's a whole, you know, that's a side of it that I'm going to get more into in a novel later. But that ties right into something I just posted on my Facebook page, which is a Harvard study showed that the government did something in terms of colluding with the big pharma to push these OxyContins and oxycodones, like you're talking about, to spread addiction even more, spread opiate addiction even more. So I can totally agree, think that what you're saying about the Sackler family is a big part of this.
Well, that's you're referring, I think, probably to the time release issue, where they said that to avoid the addictive qualities of it, so that people couldn't break into it and they couldn't crush it and snort it and everything, they were going to come up with this time release version, which actually ended up becoming more addictive over time. There are a number of interesting things there. One was that the Purdue Pharma, their patent was running out, and because the FDA cannot get drug companies to do a lot of testing on children under the age of 10, they give you a special waiver to extend your patent if you are willing to test your drug on children. And of course, Purdue Pharma said, yes, we'll happily do that. And they got an extension on that patent. So, you know, I was just wondering based on what your wide experience, because you're probably maybe the leading expert, at least in the United States, on this topic. Do you have any inclination or any sense about what's going on with the OxyContin crisis and how it's bleeding into the heroin crisis? And this interesting data that's come out that a huge portion of the prescriptions that continue to be refilled or have been refilled over the last few years are not so much for pain, but as a replacement for other mood-altering drugs.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that's a lot. You just told a whole lot, and I agree with a lot of what you said, Joe. And what I found is that a lot of people that I know that have developed heroin addicts, like an increasingly large percentage. I started working in the field in 1989, and just as an addictions counselor, and then I went back to grad school to get a more advanced degree. And I still have an expertise in addictions, but I now deal with, bipolar disorder, and I developed an expertise with post-traumatic stress disorder with a new technique for that, and dissociative identity disorder and other things. But with the addictions, I found that over the years, there's been a huge increase in the amount of people whose opiate addiction started with the painkillers. And it just follows, with what you're saying about all that. Now, in my book, though, there were so many drugs to cover that I decided I had to set a limit by not going into the pharmaceutical drugs. And so that's what stopped me from exploring the kinds of subjects you're talking about with the Purdue pharmaceuticals and all that. But I have read some of what you're talking about, and I definitely think that from what I've seen that's a huge part of the opioid, of course, epidemic, is a concerted effort to just basically increase the amount of opiate addicts. And those opiate addicts almost, a huge percentage of them turn to heroin after the painkillers. It's very sad.
And oddly enough, the United States cannot extricate itself from one of the leading heroin-producing countries on the planet, which would be Afghanistan.
Right. And that's the longest war in American history, and the Vietnam War was the second longest war in American history, and that's the Golden Triangle and the Golden Crescent of poppy.
What a shock, huh?
Yeah, right.
I have one more follow-up, because you mentioned raves earlier, and I am fascinated by MDMA, which... when it broke onto the scene, and I remember when it was being touted in the 80s in particular as being kind of a wonder drug for therapists, and it got away from therapy. It just sort of it was no longer a tool for therapy, but I see it starting to come back around now as a tool for therapy. Is there something that strange that happened in the story of MDMA and how it may or may not have been weaponized in the 90s?
Yeah, I think it was weaponized. It's still weaponized, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger weapon because of groups like the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies and the Hefter Institute, among two or three. There's about three or four of these different think tanks. Those are the two biggest, though. And those groups have direct links to the Human Ecology Fund. Human Ecology Fund was a CIA front company that came out in Anthropology Today, the leading anthropology magazine. And so, you know, Leary was got his funds from the Human Ecology Fund, you know, the CIA front company. And Leary, you know, ended up saying in an interview that he's been working for the CIA most of his career. So, you know, and that, so the Human Ecology Fund, Leary was just one, just represented one college of over 100 colleges that had got this money for the experiments to spread and popularize LSD. And so with MDMA, with ecstasy, what's found, I mean, there, you can just look at some of these studies. There's studies all over the world. We're talking about dozens of studies. They're finding that ecstasy is so clearly causing memory problems and some depression issues in 10 hits or less. And
right.
It's really sad how clear the evidence is, how clear the tests are, but yet you have these groups like MAPS and Hefter. Hefter's partly funded by the Rockefellers, who also help fund the Human Ecology Fund and MKUltra. And, you know, MAPS is partly funded by the Pritzker's family. It's you know, a number of billionaires in the Pritzker family. And, you know, so you got these groups that are just funding loads of doctors in different the top colleges that were also involved in MKUltra, such as, you know, Hopkins, Harvard, et cetera. And just, you know, only like giving the final parts of the funding if you gave them positive data. And now the NIH is actually going to follow through with some of this, you know, data and say, well, let's try, you know, mushrooms. Let's try psychedelic mushrooms as an antidepressant on all people with depression, for example. It's, according to my brother, just told me about that. And this is, you know, my brother actually has just got a job as chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. And over dinner the other day, he's telling me this, and I'm just like, my God, you know, I thought you read my book, you know, and I'm just saying, I can't believe you're even telling me this. You know,
what's hot out here in Silicon Valley right now is microdosing LSD.
Yeah, that's a new big thing, is the microdosing. Okay, maybe, I don't know. I don't know what a little
Hold a second. What is microdosing?
So the idea is that if you take low doses of LSD like you would take a morning multivitamin, not enough to cause actual psychedelic tripping, but mm-hmm. enough to ameliorate your psychology so that you supposedly become very creative and very focused at the same time. And
well, you know, you guys talking about Timothy Leary. To me, the one who popularized LSD was Cary Grant in a series of articles in the Saturday Evening Post when he regaled the nation with his experience every day going to a psychiatrist so that he could become Cary Grant. He said always inside he was Archie Leach, this poor kid born in England who at 14 ran away from home and joined a tumbling act, okay? But he said he always dreamed he could be Cary Grant. And these articles, I mean, they praised, he gave LSD credit for turning him into Cary Grant. He said it was the first time in his life that he was happy, and he was almost 50 years of age at the time and the most successful actor in the world who ended up owning his movies.
Yeah, now, it's very sad. The American Psychiatric Association, many psychiatrists were indirectly, I don't know if there were some that were directly working with MKUltra, but lots of them were indirectly working with MKUltra. It was really pushed on psychiatry to get as many influential people as possible you know, tripping on acid, and they used it in therapy that way, and to popularize it before they outlawed it. And that's how you got someone like Cary Grant, you know, popularizing. And then you get the, you know, the media, which are interlocked with these top defense contractors and, you know, banks and insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. And that's how they push their agenda so easily, is they, you know, put a huge megaphone on Cary Grant after manipulating him in their psychiatric sessions to, you know, laud LSD.
I must tell you, I wish some nights that my show could be 2 hours, because I could listen to you two talk and exchange ideas and opinions and observations and information for another 60 minutes. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but John, you will definitely be back here again. They can get your two books at Amazon. And Joe,
it's great talking to you, Joe.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, you will, Joe. And tomorrow, you're going to be on Chuck Cocelli.
No, I'm actually now down to one appearance a month. And so I'm the first Tuesday of every month.
Oh, okay. So you'll be on the first Tuesday in...
Next week.
Okay, terrific. Anyway, thank you both very, very much. I just love listening to the both of you. You make the show really, really worthwhile. Best of luck, Joe. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. John, I'll probably be talking to you on this show again in about 2 months. And thank you again for coming on tonight.
Thank you, John.
Ed Murrow used to say, good night, folks, and good luck.
Sunny, 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 sunny.